No one has any explanation for specifically why at this late date the differentiation has been made. There is a lot of grumbling on the part of the fishermen, laborers, townspeople who have been gathering regularly at these meetings. As I've said before, anywhere else in the world you wouldn't get in the room without press credentials. Here at least we do. We have been allowing free intermingling of the press and the public. At this point, we do have the room divided between press and public, and again, there's a lot of grumbling about it. Rumors are also flying afoot, as usual, this time of year in Valdez, but today, of course, we've got a lot richer environment for the rumors to grow. Hopefully at the Exxon briefing, we'll get answers to at least dispel some of the allegations or accusations that are running around the room. We do have some advance notice. The pace of press briefings and press interactions will apparently be slowing down. Going into the day, we had scheduled an Exxon morning briefing at 11 and an Exxon evening briefing at 6. We have received word that the Exxon evening briefing has been canceled. There will just be one Exxon press conference today. That will be the meeting starting here in a few minutes at 11 o'clock. The 6 o'clock meeting is not scheduled. Tomorrow, which is Saturday, April 1st, there will be no Exxon conferences. At least there are none scheduled. Perhaps if there is breaking news, we may have something happen. And, of course, agencies like NOAA, the NTSB, the Coast Guard, or the state have often been springing press briefings or announcements with little or no prior notice or warning to the press corps or to the public. But there is nothing at this point scheduled for Saturday, April 1st. On Sunday, April 2nd, Exxon has reserved the Civic Center for a 4 p.m. press briefing at 4 in the afternoon. And that 11 o'clock meeting about to start here and 4 p.m. on Sunday are the only two public press conferences currently scheduled over the weekend here in Valdez. Again, we don't get much notice on some of the agency briefings, so there may be other meetings. If there are, we will broadcast them. Again, the meeting place today segregated, divided between press and public. They're also starting last night. There was a presence by the Valdez Police Department that had not been seen before. There are people at the front door, police officers at the press entrance, checking press credentials of people coming in the front entrance. And again, that is a new development. We don't know whether this was requested by the Civic Center, whether it was requested by Exxon, or whether it simply was a precautionary measure directed by the Valdez Department of Emergency Services. We'll try to find that out for you. We are into the eighth day of the incident. This is Friday. A week ago Friday morning, the Exxon Valdez ran aground. That tanker is still aground on Bly Reef, some 25 miles from downtown Valdez, through Valdez Narrows and down the long fjord out to the entrance of the Valdez Arm to Prince William Sound. Salvage crews are at work. The Exxon San Francisco is alongside the stricken Exxon Valdez, lightering off the fuel oil at a rate, we're told, of around 8,000 barrels per hour. Exxon predicted confidently last night they should have the tanker emptied by Saturday. And then, of course, we're waiting word, perhaps we'll hear this morning, on what the salvage prospects are. An increasing concern over the fate of marine mammals, wildlife, birds, and commercial fisheries activities in the Sound. Last night at the NOAA briefing, we began to get the beginnings of the first hard information about specific environmental impact, and also a strong statement by Dr. Kay Frost of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that you had to walk the beaches to see the damage, that even from 50 feet in the air in a helicopter or 100 yards off the shore in a boat, you could not see the oiled birds on the black beaches. But as you walked along the beaches, she said she saw hundreds. This information, the first real hard evidence to come back from a source that industry and government officials will acknowledge. Throughout the course of these meetings, fishermen, people from the area, environmentalists who've gone out to the islands have come back stating they had seen this or that. But overflights by helicopters from Exxon and federal and state officials had not confirmed it. Now that the agency officials have gotten crews out in amongst the islands of the Sound on the beaches, official reports are beginning to come back indicating, beginning to indicate, I should say, what may be the extent of environmental or damage to the wildlife and marine life of the Sound area. And no sign of the Exxon spokesman as yet. We've also have been advised that they won't be coming in the front door anymore. The heated feelings in the environmental community and among some of the fishermen and particularly among some of the laboring groups who are still waiting to be called out have resulted in heightened tensions. The last few meetings basically became shouting matches between locals and the Exxon and industry officials. I think I mentioned last night that only about half the questions asked were asked by the press, so that we can anticipate, I think, a very spirited exchange this morning, although we don't know if the Exxon officials will try to clamp down on the free interchange that has been the scene up to now. George Nelson, the president of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, has entered the briefing room and is up on the podium. I don't see any of the other Exxon officials yet. Again, we expect the conference to get underway in a matter of minutes. Don Cornett of Exxon has now entered. He's posting charts. I expect it'll be about 5 minutes until the actual conference begins. We'll right now go back to the studio where James Winchester is holding forth. And James, why don't you take it and stand by. We'll let you know when the conference is underway. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center.
President of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Dr. Randall Davis was going to be here to talk about the mammal rescue plan, and I've just learned that he did get an oiled otter in and he's staying there to work on it, so he won't be here for this conference. We'll start with Mr. Al Rossi giving an update on the oil spill cleanup effort.
That was Don Cornett of Exxon Anchorage introducing Frank Iroxi, president of
Exxon
Shipping.
Good morning and welcome to day eight. I'd like to do is just take a little time to recap where we've been since day one, then give you an update on what's happening right now. The Exxon response team as of last night is 196 people, about 60 of which are Exxon employees. We've got about 200 people on shore gangs and another 200 on boats. All of these people are working their hearts out. Speaking certainly for the Exxon people, we're as sad and as angered as anybody, as everyone. However, we can't let those feelings out. We need to keep our focus on battling this slick, and we're doing that with all of our energy and all of our attention and everything else that we can muster. We're still a very strong group, and we're still at it. We have developed a very high degree of cooperation with the state agencies and the U.S. Coast Guard, and we're now moving ahead in a number of coordinating committees. We can hardly keep up with them. I'll go through some of them, and planning different phases and carrying out different parts of the operation. When the initial Exxon party arrived from Houston Friday afternoon, we were confronted with three major problems. Just let me put them in focus. We had 240,000 barrels of oil on the water. We had a damaged tanker resting on the Pinnacle. In the first assessment I got from our computer analysis when I got here Friday night was that the vessel, if it slipped off the Pinnacle, would probably capsize. And of course the problem that would present is that the vessel then contained another million barrels of crude oil. So we had our work cut out for us. Let me briefly review what has occurred since we arrived, update the situation, and then address any of your questions that you may have on the response activities going on. First, the million barrel spill, or the million barrel, sorry. We've been doing everything we can to keep it from being a spill. First, a million barrels in the tanker when we arrived. We began immediately to plan the transfer or lightering of that cargo off the damaged vessel into other tankers. We could not use the ship's cargo system because we believe that the cargo piping in the tanks is damaged and we were not able to take a suction. We shifted to using emergency salvage pumps. We currently have 10 such pumps in operation. We are currently transferring at a rate of 12,000 barrels per hour. As of noon today, we will have transferred a total of 675,000 barrels off of the damaged tanker. And that's roughly two-thirds of the problem we faced when we got here. We still have some 325,000 barrels of crude oil in the vessel, so we still have a threat that is even larger than the initial spill. So we're going at that with all of the energy we have. We should complete the transfer to the Exxon San Francisco by Saturday afternoon, at which time we'll have something like 970,000 barrels of cargo off. That's Saturday afternoon. We'll still have about 30,000 barrels of cargo on board, and of course we got something like 600,000 barrels of oily seawater in the vessel. We plan to move a third vessel, Exxon Baytown, into position and to transfer the remaining 30,000 barrels of cargo and as much of that heavy oily seawater as we can. We hope to have all of the transfer operations completed by Sunday afternoon. The residual pollution problem we're going to have is the vessel itself, and that's 600,000 barrels of seawater, which has a significant or immeasurable oil content to it. Still represents a pollution problem. We have completed our planning for the salvage operations. That's as far as the refloat of the vessel. We've got blanks on board, and we're making initial preparations to blank off all of the air exits from the tanks and to move equipment in place for the start of the salvage operations. We've developed initial input from the local pilots and local diving crews to develop a list of sites to move the vessel once it is refloated. We need to do that because we need to make a underwater survey to tell us what the condition of that bottom is. Hopefully we will find it in position that we can move it out. That's our hope. If that's not the case, then we're going to have to make some emergency repairs in place. But our objective is to get it out of Prince William Sound just as quickly as we can. We're going to be working, and we have initiated the development of another working group in which we can work with the state, with the local representatives, with representatives of the fishing groups and the Native Alaskan groups. And this is going to be a very consensus decision as to where we move the vessel once we refloat it. The challenge is we need to be able to anchor it, and that means it's got to be about 40 fathoms of water at the most. And we need to be free of currents so that the divers could do their analysis, their survey, and if needed, some emergency repairs. And we'll be doing only the minimum necessary to get it out of Prince William Sound. So we need some place to anchor. 40 fathoms in most parts of the world is easy, but it's pretty difficult in Prince William Sound to find a place that that shallow. And besides that, we'll need to protect it from the weather and principally from the currents. So we're working with the divers, with the pilots, and we'll be moving into a much bigger group now, working with representatives of all of the local groups. We need to carefully study the tides, which will occur over the next week, to decide exactly when we attempt the refloat. Our initial guess is it'll be somewhere between Wednesday and Friday of next week when we have the highest tides. We are well along in removing the threat from the million barrels in a damaged vessel, and we are gaining confidence that we can also control the residual pollution problem from the vessel and the 600,000 barrels of oily seawater. The most difficult problem for us has been dealing with the 240,000 barrels on water in Prince William Sound. And of course, that was released shortly after the grounding. We have actually fought three distinct battles with this oil. And I'd like to go through, if I can, just very quickly to brief you on on what has been a real moving target. The initial area of the spill when we got here was about 6 square miles, and it was off of Bly Island and south of the grounding site. It's just about in this area. We deployed the 7 skimmers that were available during that Saturday and Sunday in an operation like this. There's actually 4, 5 spots. Some of the skimming systems, we have 2 to a barge. So there were 5 actual barges or units, but 7 skimming systems operating from those units. We had, as of Saturday night, an agreed plan with the local fishing groups and the local state authorities to move all the boom we had into place to protect certain areas to the east of the spill site, which were felt by the fishermen and the state groups as most sensitive. One was here, I think, at Galena Bay, and there were a couple areas just to the east of the spill. We had a burn test Saturday afternoon, proved to be very, very effective, and we got permission from the state on Sunday afternoon, I think it was about 3:30 p.m., to go ahead with burning operations, particularly as the at the outer edges of the slick where it was encroaching into zone 2. That's the most sensitive area. And we were going to be taking isolated segments of that slick and igniting it and burning it. We also had a dispersant test on Saturday afternoon. We requested permission to use dispersant. We were asked to run additional tests on Sunday. We did that. We got permission from the authorities to use dispersant. We got that permission at 6:45 p.m. Sunday night. And at that point, we were ready to go. We had a coordinated plan that we worked out with the state and with the Coast Guard, which involved using 3 techniques, aerial dispersant spray in zone 1, which was about the center of the spill, and then around the periphery of the spill we were going to burn, and we would continue our skimming operations. That's where we stood, ready to fight the first battle. And of course, that night we were hit with very high winds, 50 miles an hour with gusts up to 73, blew part of the roof off the terminal at the airport, came close to damaging a number of our helicopters, which would have been catastrophic to us. We were grounded on Monday morning because of the high winds. The FAA would not allow any flights. We did get surveillance aircraft, both ours and the Coast Guard's, off the ground about 10:15, and by shortly afternoon, around 12 or 12:30, we had the surveillance results, which confirmed our worst fears, and that is that the slick had moved during the night and morning when we were blacked out, had moved 37 miles. So the slick moved from a position about here and had moved toward the southwest and was beginning to impact Naked Island, this area in here, and was beginning to move further south into the area here. There was one big concentration up, up to the northwest of Eleanor Island, and then also a concentration down in here around Smith Island. We requested permission to use dispersant in this area between Seal Island and Smith Island. We got that permission by then. It was so late in the Monday afternoon that we were not able to mount an attack on it. We did project that the slick would move down both sides of Eleanor Island and Ingat Island toward Knight Island. And at 9 p.m. Monday night, we requested permission to use dispersant in 2 areas, to the northwest and to the southeast. What we wanted to do was cut off these two prongs to keep them from drifting down both sides of Night Island. As of 12 the next day, we did not get that permission. What we wanted to do was hit it at first light. We realized and admitted that at this point the oil was beginning to emulsify. We felt we had a 10 to 20% chance of being successful with the dispersant, but even at that probability, we felt it was important to attempt it. We then, Monday was crisis management all day. We were shut down from, or hampered in our attempts to reposition our equipment because of the very high winds coming across Prince William Sound, but we did initiate and get our equipment moved into what I call our second defensive position, which was to try to collect and skim this, what we thought was the major concentration of oil just to the northwest of Night and Ingot Islands. We had all this boom that was in this area, and rather than do anything with that boom here, with the guidance from the fishing groups and the state, they indicated that they were four very, very important and sensitive areas, and we needed to concentrate all of our boom in a defensive pattern in those four areas. And they were here. I believe there are two areas here and one right here at Sawmill Bay. So we concentrated all of our boom defensively there to protect those areas. We had our skimmers. By the way, we had seven up here. We had grown to 12 by the time we got into this position on Tuesday. And that's the way the situation stayed until, what's today, Friday, until, through Wednesday into Thursday. Yesterday, again, the weather foiled us this time. It was what I understand is a very unusual westerly wind that moved that oil through the passages between Eleanor and Ingot and between Ingot and Night. And now, as you see, all this green is where the oil currently is, with the heaviest concentration being down the east side of Night Island. There is some oil still here. What we have now moved into the third phase of this battle, and let me call that the Battle of Sawmill Bay, because we absolutely have to do everything we can to protect this area. We've got three defense lines of boom trying to protect, that will protect Sawmill Bay. We've got 10 skimmers in this area to absolutely do everything we can, and I stress everything we can, to keep the oil from migrating down towards Sawmill Bay. There is a significant movement of oil out the Montague Strait, but we still have significant concern for oil that might be eddied into this this area.
We're listening to Frank Arrosti of Exxon Shipping.
Let me get back to the second phase. We had a burn test on Monday afternoon, and that was unsuccessful. By Monday afternoon, the oil patches had a significant quantity of water emulsified in them, and we were not able to ignite the patches. So we are down to booming defensively and skimming as we can. We have, I think at this point, 40 cargo liners of equipment and material that have been brought in. We're up to the C-5A and C-47 type of aircraft, so it's really big stuff that we're moving in. In addition to the skimming systems that we have in place, we've got six skimmers that should be in Anchorage shortly after noon. We'll need time to transport them to Prince William Sound and set them up and move them in position. Our problem right now is that most of the skimming equipment in the world is ineffective because we're now into the very heavy oil phase. As this sad incident has progressed, the oil has gathered a greater water content, and it's now something like the consistency of black mayonnaise. And that gives most skimming equipment problems. We now have to go to skimming systems that have auger pumps or a screw-type positive displacement pumps to move this. There are a number of other activities going on. We have four beach cleanup groups and in the planning. And if I can get the right piece of paper, I'll tell you a little bit about that. The first is the cleanup priorities, the definition of cleanup priorities. That group is headed by Dave Kennedy of NOAA, and there's participation by all of the local groups, plus the state and the federal groups, plus Exxon, and we'll be setting up priorities as to what we clean first. There is a second group which is looking at each of these locations individually and determining what cleanup methods we use for each of these locations. That's headed up by Andy Teal of Exxon. We've got a logistics support group because we're going to have groups in the field for a long time, and we're going to be supporting all of this activity from the seaside. We're not going to set up camps on any of these uninhabited islands. We're going to be trying to do this cleanup as sensitively as we can. We don't want to make the matters any worse as we go through the cleanup itself. So we have to set up motherships or support ships and then move the work crews from there into specific beach sites. And we've got to begin to get all of that in place to start the cleanup. Those of you who are familiar or who perhaps were not familiar before the past couple days but have flown over it know that this is an immense area. From Valdez down to this area where we're now interacting, it's some 70 or 80 miles. So we've got a very, very significant logistics problem ahead of us, and we're moving ahead to set up floating logistics points. We've also have a fourth committee group which is working on disposal. As we gather this oil off the beaches and off the water, we need to dispose of it. And then there's a fifth group that will be organized at the appropriate time, which is to assess the shoreline condition after the cleanup crew and determine what else has to be done, so that is kind of the quality control on the operation. We also, as it was mentioned last night, have set up a $10 million assistance fund. That $10 million has been deposited in the Bank of Alaska. The purpose of that is to aid those individuals, those people who have been impacted by this but are not yet in the position to where they can assess the degree of their problem and are not in the position to develop a claim. But they still need some assistance because they've been impacted. So they will be able to, and this is an Exxon operation, this is not through outside claims adjusters. Exxon will be making decisions as people come forward, and what we'll be looking for first to make sure that the individual really is in the business, that individual has been impacted. We'll try to make a very rough assessment as to what the potential impact in dollars is, and we'll try to advance that individual funds. This is interest-free assistance, and we'll be settling it all up later when full claims are in place. But this is an effort to get money to the people who have been impacted and aren't in position to develop a full claim yet. Okay, Don.
That was Frank Arasi, president of Exxon Shipping.
Okay,
now Don Cornett is back.
Dr. Alice Berkner, talk a little bit about the Bird Rescue Center.
Down please turn the public address down just a little bit? It's feeding back.
Thank you. Just very briefly, we are starting, quite a few of the people from the press here have been over to the center. We are starting to gear up now, and we're going to have to do a lot of concentration on tasks at hand. I think some of you are aware of small incident that took place at the facility yesterday, and we now have controlled access to the building. We're going to be doing tasks at certain times of the day with the birds. Those of you who need access to them will be notified, and we can bring you in and... Thank you. Just very briefly, we are starting, quite a few of the people from the press here have been over to the center. We are starting to gear up now, and we're going to have to do a lot of concentration on tasks at hand. I think some of you are aware of small incident that took place at the facility yesterday, and we now have controlled access to the building. We're going to be doing tasks at certain times of the day with the birds. Those of you who need access to them will be notified, and we can bring you in small groups rather than everyone together. We hope that this works out, and we hope that you understand that we have to get on with the process and do our jobs. We have tried to cooperate to the best of our ability to get you the information you need. We realize that you have your jobs to do, and now we ask for your cooperation in allowing us to do our jobs as well.
Thank you, Dr. Bergner.
Okay, we'll take questions now.
Birds that have already been brought to the center. Could Dr. Bird address that first?
How many are there?
Yeah, how many are there?
B-E-R-K, N as in Nancy, E-R. The birds we've received so far have been, two have been very heavily oiled and one has been moderately oiled. And I'm sorry, could you repeat the other question?
How many birds are there?
We only have three at present.
Three?
That's correct.
So the rest that are out there are now in carcasses or they're still out there unrescued? What's the status of the birds out there?
The status of the birds out there is, there are a lot, I've got to explain that there are a lot of stereotypes connected with all wildlife and oil spills. One of those stereotypes is that the minute the oil hits the water, there are going to be oil birds. That's not necessarily true. If you don't have a large population of birds in the area of the initial spill, obviously they're not going to get hit. We were fortunate at the time of the spill to have low density of birds in the particular area. So that's one of the reasons that we haven't seen a lot of oil birds involved up until this point. It does take birds time to come on shore once they have been oiled. They are extremely hardy creatures. They are not mammals. They don't react to thermal stress the way we do. They don't react to other factors in many instances the way we do. The oil has now moved down to an area where there are more birds involved, so this is why we're seeing them at this point.
Do you expect to receive a lot of birds? I mean, the rest, it's such an immense area, and the ability to find and quickly transport something as fragile as a bird this distance seems to me to be very difficult. Do you really expect to receive the kinds of populations of birds for cleaning that people are used to seeing in oil spills in the lower 48? Or
there is a possibility. All right, we have boats out there in the area. They are being gathered on the beaches. They're being pre-treated on the boats. In other words, they're given treatment. Their mouths are cleaned from the oil. They're wrapped in rags to prevent further preening, and they're given fluids by stomach tube. When we have birds collected, we then notify the people, notify us, and we send out aircraft to bring them back in.
So you're doing that now?
Yes, that's in place now, and we expect to get more boats involved. Could you
I'm sorry, but we're trying to find out exactly how far along this is. Have you picked up birds on the boats yet?
Yes, we have. As a matter of fact, just before I left, we were arranging helicopter transportation out there to pick some up and bring some back. But we were in the middle of that, and not all the boats had reported in. But one of the things I wanted to add further to your question is that, yes, the geography up here works against collection, as it would in any remote area. I did a spill over Christmas in Washington State where we ended up with 3,000 birds over a four-week period, but there we were working with long, broad beaches. Out here, there are small, rocky beaches. We have to approach the birds from the sea. I would imagine they regard us as predators. Their first instinct is to get away from us, so they see us coming, and they're going to get right back into the water. You have to stop and consider things from the bird's point of view as well. Next question.
How many birds can you take in and how long can you hold them?
If done properly, I have released birds as soon as 8 hours after washing. We are not expecting at this point massive numbers of birds all at once because of logistics, because of the wide area covered. We are looking into a larger facility. If we get birds over a period of time in small numbers, we probably can manage at the facility we have, but we are looking into another facility.
Yesterday we were told that they were planning on holding the birds until the sound was clean.
I'm sorry, could you speak up?
Yesterday we were told that you were going to be holding birds until it was safe to release them back into the sound so they don't go out and get dirty again.
Well, that's something that we'll be discussing with the wildlife agencies involved as to where they would be released once they are cleaned.
We do know we're out there. Air traffic is a little limited today. How are we going to get the birds in when nobody's flying?
Well, obviously, when nobody's flying, we're certainly not going to have aircraft out there.
Our First Amendment rights are being abridged. Our First Amendment rights to ask questions are being abridged. Why is this press being here? However, we are so God. The public has a right to know what's going on here.
Well, I'm trying to answer questions as best I can.
I want to know why you're not hiring people to help this. I want to know what is the priority of Exxon. Yesterday, Mr. Cornett stated that the reason why they're not letting volunteers on this project to clean up this oil is that they won't pay the workmen's compensation.
No.
My question is, what's more important, the environment or paying workmen's compensation? Are you really more concerned about money or the environment?
You misquoted me, sir. I said we didn't put volunteers on there because we preferred to put them on the payroll so we could pay workmen's compensation. Now, I think that we should give Dr. Berkner an opportunity to answer all the questions about birds. I've been up here trying to answer bird questions for 4 or 5 days.
I don't think she's ready to answer anymore.
Okay. When she's prepared to do that. At this point, let's take some questions for anybody else. Go ahead, sir.
Cornett, we have now for days been hearing about efforts to clean up 1,000 barrels of oil that are out there. And whenever I ask each morning how many barrels have actually been cleaned up, we've been given very, very low numbers. Yesterday, I think the number was 7,000 to 8,000 gallons.
Barrels.
We've been continuing to ask how many birds are picked up, how many animals have been salvaged and saved.
We just gave you the answer to both of them.
Right. We get numbers like one oiled otter or three oiled birds. It's been 8 days.
Are you restless that you're not oiling enough birds?
Well, what I'm getting at is when is someone, it just seems to me, and I think most of us out here, that this whole thing is a miserable failure.
No, what it is not a soap opera. It's a cleanup. We're not going to oil birds so you can have something to shoot at.
But we're seeing
good.
We're seeing we're seeing birds and we're seeing animals out there. Photographers bring back pictures of hundreds of birds. We had this report from Kathy Frost, I think her name is, last night, who talked about all these birds on the beaches, all these animals that she'd seen that were oiled. And yet, whenever we ask how many birds and how many animals have been rescued, we get...
You just got the answer, the best answer you can get. Dr. Berkner runs the Bird Rescue Center. She told you that she has cleaned three birds and she has boats in the area picking birds up. She doesn't know how many birds are on the boats, but they will be brought in. They're being cared for there. And it is a matter of time before the birds get oiled, and hopefully not many of them will.
I'm not disputing the numbers. The question I'm asking is, isn't it obvious that this thing was almost untreatable from the very beginning, and hasn't it gotten away from Exxon and everyone else?
Absolutely not. It hasn't gotten away at all. We are making good progress on the cleanup of this oil spill. Skimming is very slow. We've treated the primary problem first, and that is making sure we don't make the spill worse with the loss of the tanker. And we are skimming the oil up, and we are putting people and resources in the field to make certain that we get all the oil, whether we skim it up or we scoop it up or wipe it up or whatever, but we're going to get it. Let's just calm down just a minute. Let's keep this a little bit orderly. Yes, sir, you have a question?
Yes, I do. Is it true that in 1982, Exxon was sued by a seaman who charged that he had been abused by Captain Hazelwood, who was inebriated on board the vessel? Do you know anything about that lawsuit, Mr. Iarossi?
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
Yes, there was a complaint, which we... investigated, is now a subject of litigation.
So you knew as far back as 1982 that Captain Hazelwood may have been drunk while on board the vessel?
I did not know that.
Well, that was the allegation in the lawsuit.
This was prior to the voluntary rehabilitation program.
Okay, do we have another question?
Right here.
Yes, sir.
Yesterday, you stated that Exxon opened a claims account with $10 million in it. That's 1% of a billion. And I should say just 1% from a company that has profits, which we're talking about take-home pay, after taxes,
sir,
of billions of dollars.
Do you have a question?
This is a question.
I'm not here to listen to your speech. If you have a question,
Captain,
I'll answer it for you.
On the tour boat, Vince Petty was paid $6,000 yesterday to deliver 100 sandwiches. The price of gasoline, retail prices in the lower 48, has risen 10 cents a gallon. Do you expect to show a loss, break even, or have a profit for this year on this tragedy?
We will.
Raising the prices of gas in the lower 48 already because of this tragedy right here. You're spending $6,000 to deliver 100 sandwiches. So...
You don't believe that. I don't believe that. You know nobody's going to spend $6,000 to deliver 100 sandwiches. Does somebody have a question that bears on this, or shall we? Okay, I will recognize you. A question, not a speech.
The question is, given the fact that the oil industry is getting a tremendous tax break under the economic limit factor to the tune of $100 million a year, how can you justify your minimalist approach to this problem? You've only hired 600 people. You need 1,000. You're making a lot of money off that oil, but you're not giving anything back.
Why are people being sued?
One question at a time, or I'm going to stop this press conference right now. If you want to answer questions, want me to answer questions, ask them one at a time. I'll answer anything you want to ask, even this ridiculous stuff that's going on right back here. We pay...
Is the tax break justified?
You bet your booties. Yes, it's justified. We pay... Three companies in this state pay off...
That say a strong oil industry means jobs for Alaskans. Where's my job? Where do people in this town want to help clean up the spill? You're not hiring.
Thank you very much.
This is Dave Hammack from the Valdez Civic Center. The press conference has pretty much come to a conclusion.
I'm from the Cordova District Fishermen's Union.
We have a desperate plea that we'd like to put forth to the world. We need ocean standard, high seas barrier boom material in 36-inch and 48-inch size. This is the quality of boom material we need to protect our fish hatcheries. We can't seem to get it through Exxon. The fishermen would like to protect their fish hatcheries. Please publish this plea for us. We need to come up with this material. Exxon can't deliver.
Michelle, what's your question?
This is, again, Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. This press conference is totally out of control. You can hear the bedlam, the shouting. The Exxon officials are leaving by a rear exit. The press corps is attempting to follow. There are folks out in the audience, as you've heard. Crowd is, well, you can hear the crowd around me. Many of the people who are shouting are members of the local labor union or members of the labor union who have been dispatched to Valdez but have yet to be hired, demanding jobs. We heard just heard a representative from CDFU in Cordova making a plea for the World Press to publish this request for boom material. At this point, people are running in every direction. This is certainly become more of a media event than a press conference. Evidently, the attempts or the segregation of the House into audience and or public and the press was as a result of rumors that were growing such an event was likely to happen. It's very difficult to have any idea what is going on in the room right now. Press is running in one direction and then another. People are standing up here and there making their statements, shouting them out. Again, Don Cornett of Exxon simply cut off the press conference when the control of the flow of questions was lost. I think the dust is settling. Most of the people have left the room. I'll try if I can to recap a little bit of the just what went on. The meeting started with a statement by Don Cornett, who is the has been the spokesman for Exxon throughout this throughout these later meetings. Frank Arossi, the first the president of Exxon Shipping, hosted the first few press conferences a week ago. Don Cornett more and more has been taking over that role. Earlier, again, the press conference, Cornett introduced people. Arossi gave a recap, a fairly lengthy recap of the different stages of the oil spill response over the weeks. Stand by. We may have something happening.
But it seemed, I think, as you will attest, that things seem to be getting out of hand. We don't want any problems here. We don't want people hurt. Citizens are here. They could indeed be...
3 days for another press conference.
Why not? We're offering, if you want to talk to...
We're not sure who's speaking. It's all happening behind a curtain on the exit from the auditorium. We don't know who's talking. We'll continue to broadcast
the
complaints by the press and the public to evidently members of Exxon.
I'm saying that you can talk to us at the press office.
But then nobody's there, right?
We're not.
We're not. Meet with the press for 2 days.
You guys have enough egg on your face.
For Pete's sake.
Our number is 835-5548. 5547.
Where are you located?
I don't want a number.
Physically,
we're in the Westmark Hotel.
How do we get to you?
We're always busy because of the number of press calls we're coming through. We've tried to be responsive to the press. We have been conducting these things twice a day.
Can we see Mr. Arossi now and ask him about the questions we hope to ask him here and also about what happened out in the hallway?
Mr. Arossi, as I've mentioned, as he's told you many times, his main concern is to get the oil cleaned up. He can't make himself available throughout the day.
He'd already set aside this time to talk to the press, and
I
we
agree.
Were deprived of
we're
it. So let's go talk to him now.
We didn't before Sunday
you.
Night.
We didn't deprive you of that time. We tried to make ourselves available.
We were back here separate from this disruption, and you wouldn't let us talk to him.
Again, in a public building.
So the time has been blocked out by Exxon to talk to the press. So why can't the press go talk to Exxon now?
I think we need to regroup. We have to go back to our offices. It's our intention to really keep you guys informed. We've been trying to do it.
Why do you go ask questions?
Because, number one, at the Westmark Hotel, you can't go barging up there. That's our control center. If we allowed all the press to come charging up to the top room, do you think we'd get any work done?
We're having a press conference tonight or tomorrow morning or the next day or Sunday morning. Why are we now off till late Sunday?
Comment on why you're going to wait 48 hours for the next press conference.
I don't know exactly why. I think one of the considerations is the fact that, and we met because of the results of this press conference here and the fact that your questions weren't fully answered, we need to go back and regroup, as I mentioned, and examine, are there other ways that we can keep you informed? That's our intention, to keep you folks informed. This was not a forum that seemed to work out well today because the instructions are the public. Our intention was to answer any questions that came today. Don Coronet mentioned that. We'll have to go back and regroup and examine if there's other ways to keep the press informed, the nation informed, of what's going on here. That's our intention. If we can work out a way that maybe we do indeed need to rethink having a press conference tomorrow because this did not work well, we'll have to examine those options and see how they go.
So you have more oil out there than any spill in U.S. history, and you want to keep the nation informed, but
yes,
you're not going to talk to any reporter between now and 4 p.m. Sunday.
I think up until this point in time, and I'm sure continuing in the future, I think you guys can attest that we really have tried to be very good and meet with you twice a day. Because of the disruption in this press conference today, again, we'll have to rethink our plans.
This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. I can't see what's going on anywhere where I have microphones. We've been listening to an Exxon press official, I don't know, responding to members of the press about the press briefing schedule. I understand that there's a Greenpeace statement being made out in the auditorium, out in the lobby. We do have a microphone out there. I'll bring you that now. This is a Greenpeace spokesman.
They're full of it.
Do you have contacts with other groups of Greenpeace, for example, in Europe, who have a lot of experience with such accidents?
Yeah, I mean, our groups have been involved with, like, what happened in the North Sea. I mean, it's, you know, it is travesty against the environment, and so, of course,
mobilize them.
Yeah, I mean, people will certainly be quite upset about this.
What did you have in the bag, please,
clothes,
for me?
Which I had to dump out to show them before they'd let go of me.
So there was no
nothing.
Dead sea otter.
There was nothing.
No oil bird.
No, nothing.
Why do you think they handled you so violently?
Because they wouldn't let go of my arm until I did.
Why were you bringing your dirty clothes with you?
Why not? Is it against the law?
No, just what?
I wanted to bring them in. I didn't have time to go home.
Traveling late, huh?
What was it?
It's my dirty laundry. I'd like to go wash it sometime. Is there a problem with that?
What were you planning on saying today, if anything?
I wanted to ask him what the protocol was for turning in marine mammals live and dead. I've had a lot of people tell me, it's like, what about volunteers? Are they covered by liability? What's the deal? Turning men, turning in where?
Oiled birds, I mean, be thrown on the
those seat. Are the questions that need to be asked and answered. Yesterday they stated there were no dead marine mammals. We all know there is now. Protocol needs to be set up. I get lots of calls saying, what do I do with these? What do we do? Can we come down and help? I mean, I need those answers. That was what I was planning on asking.
Do you expect
to right now? One or two.
Three words?
One or two things.
They can quit harassing people and quit dragging people down the hall.
About the cleanup.
Dead whales, do you know anything about that?
I keep hearing that. I did a flyover yesterday and I did not see any whales, but we do keep getting reports that dead whales have been sighted, but nobody seems, when they go back to do the flyout, they can't find them, so I can't comment on whether it's happened or not.
What have you seen in your flyovers?
Just some sea lions and oiled beaches and, you know, sea lions on rocks that's oiled halfway up the rock and the sea lions are on top, and so it's stuff like that.
Do you expect support from the European members of Greenpeace?
I'm sure I will be.
Perhaps you can ask him now.
Yeah. Dave McTaggart, it's been great to have you here today. I know you've been involved with people beating you up and dragging you away by the French government. It's been nice to have you with me today.
You show me what you think about you.
We've been listening to the press out in the lobby of the Valdez Civic Center Auditorium and Ballroom. The press is clustered around Cindy Lowry. Earlier in the press conference, there was quite a commotion when the shouting and disturbances began. Evidently, security personnel, probably the Valdez Police Department, stopped someone from coming in. That person was evidently Cindy Lowry of Greenpeace, who was carrying a sack or bag Apparently, there were suspicions that there had been rumors around the auditorium here prior to the press conference that someone was going to come in and throw a dead animal up onto the stage. Whether or not that was the case, we don't know. But someone was apprehended coming in. That was Cindy Lowry of Greenpeace. That resulted in the start of the disturbances that led to Exxon curtailing this press conference. After Exxon had shut down the press conference, there was a cluster of reporters around the lone Exxon junior member of the public relations department who was left holding the exit door. It was not Don Cornette, it was somebody in the PR department. The Exxon officials all left out a rear exit of the ballroom, leaving Lai Horatio at the bridge, one of their PR people, to hold the door and to keep the press at bay. After that was done, we were able to get a microphone back to that crowd. I still have no idea who the Exxon spokesman was. You heard him discussing, answering questions to reporters about the need for Exxon to talk to the public, about the need for press conferences, and questions about what Exxon was trying to do. We then were able to get another microphone out into the lobby where the Greenpeace Cindy Lowry was making a statement. Bear in mind that both of these locations were beyond my sight, so I'm having to rely on reports that were run back to me by KCHU staff and volunteers about what was going on. Well, it has been an eventful day. The only Exxon press briefing scheduled for the day, totally disrupted by labor representatives dissatisfied with the hiring and the Alaska hire by environmentalists wanting to make their statements about the efficiency or efficacy of the cleanup procedures and the impact on the animals. The spokesman from Exxon finally becoming frustrated with the disturbances and their inability to control the questions and flow of the conversations and in dialogue. Canceling the meeting, much running about, a security problem in the lobby, police responding, people shouting, standing up, making statements. I think at this point it is pretty evident that these press conferences are no longer press conferences but are just simply media events. Every side using them, attempting to use these conferences to make their statements, to try to capture their part of the national audience. In the briefing we heard this morning, Frank Arossi did give an extensive recap of the major steps in the Exxon response from the very beginning of the oil spill. It would be too lengthy and too detailed for me to recap now, plus those who've been listening from the beginning have heard these various steps. If I can look through my notes, I believe the big questions addressed today that might be considered new information or updated information would be that Exxon is now anticipating that Sunday will be Sunday in the afternoon. The transfer of oil was expected to be completed from the Exxon Valdez, the tanker stricken on the rocks. And at that point, they will begin preparing the ship for salvage. Next week, there are extremely high tides predicted for Prince William Sound. This has raised some environmental concern. This will allow the oil loose in the southwestern sound to be deposited higher on some of the beaches. At the same time, this will be the best window of opportunity to refloat the vessel when the water is deepest over Bly Reef. Again, the Exxon Valdez normally draws between 55 and 65 feet of water. It is grounded on a reef that is only 38 feet beneath the surface of the water at average tide. The Battle of Sawmill Bay was referred to by Frank Arossi down in southwest Alaska, a new location where skimmers and booms are seeking to stop the movement of oil. A point that I didn't include in my summary last night, Exxon has established a $10 million assistance fund in response to concerns by fishermen that fish buyers pay cash, and fishermen were anticipating cash income from the herring fishery, which should be starting next week in Prince William Sound, to pay notes that were due on their boats, loans, etc. This $10 million assistance fund was designed to allow people to get quick cash draws from Exxon, interest-free, and then the end result to be resolved when the longer official claims are resolved. Those are the high points of the briefing. We begin to hear from Alice Berkner, the expert who has been brought in to organize the bird cleaning and discussions of the difficult logistics in dealing with the birds ensued. At this point, three birds are all that have been retrieved. It's 85 miles from the location where most of the birds are to Valdez. There are no roads. There are only boat or air traffic. And today, with the clouds lowering here in Prince William Sound, we no longer have the perfect flying conditions we've enjoyed for the last few days. Again, the press conference utterly disrupted by a combination of environmentalists and laborers seeking employment through union hire. The shouting that went on disrupted the meeting. Exxon walked out, exiting by a back door. Security forces are more and more in evidence at each of these meetings. No further press briefings are scheduled for today. None are currently scheduled for Saturday, April 1st. At this point, the only conference we know of, a public meeting, will be an Exxon briefing scheduled for 4 p.m. We, of course, have no ideas yet events of this conference will have any impact on Exxon's commitment to holding the Sunday meeting. We'll know that hopefully later today or tomorrow. The NTSB, the Coast Guard, NOAA, other and state agencies generally have not given much advance warning on their meetings. If there is indeed another press conference or briefing by one of the regulatory agencies or the investigating agencies, we will broadcast that and give stations and listeners as much notice as we can. We had quite a team up here for KCHU today. I want to thank APRN technician Chris Bedelic, Jeff Brown from KTOO, Mary Beth Joyce from KCHU Radio, and a volunteer.